The tobacco industry has taken a lot of criticism and had its knuckles wrapped for selling a product whose overuse can kill people. Public health efforts down through the years have largely taken cigarettes out of the hands of adolescents, but the industry has found another way to provide them with nicotine, vaping. There's increasing evidence that e-cigarettes are least as dangerous as cigarettes and even bring health risks of their own. Dr. Robert N. Proctor is a history of science professor at Stanford University who's made a study of the ways tobacco is pushed on young people. He's in town to speak at the Coalition for Tobacco-Free Hawaii's annual stakeholder meeting, and he's with us in our studio. Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
You know, if you just arrived from Mars and I said, here on Earth we've got this product where, you know, we know it kills people, we know it's addictive, and it generates, what, how many billion dollars a year?
Oh, yeah, it's hundreds of billions of dollars a year globally. We've now got 6 trillion cigarettes smoked every year, and that happens to be 350 million miles of cigarettes, which is enough to go around the Earth in a continuous chain 13,000 times. So the numbers are astronomical.
And I, as a recent arrival from Mars, not familiar with the ways of Earthlings, would find that pretty surprising. How did this happen?
Well, there's three main causes: mass production,
right,
mass marketing, and mass deception. Mm-hmm. Already in the 1880s, we had the first automatic cigarette rolling machines that could run 100,000 cigarettes per day. Mm-hmm. Now we've got machines that can run millions per day. And if everyone were making cigarettes the way they did 100 years ago, it would require a labor force of 3 million people just in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Mass marketing, then, the tobacco industry invents most of our mass marketing, product placement, paying Hollywood actors to smoke, skywriting with airplanes,
yeah,
and giant letters, Lucky Strike means fine tobacco. Mm-hmm. And then most importantly, in the 1950s, the Grand Conspiracy, the agreement made at the Plaza Hotel on December 14th, 1953, to deny all harm from cigarettes. And that resulted in the deadliest penetration of the academy, of our scientific community, in the history of the world.
And that was the tobacco companies agreed to, let's keep a lid on this, they're starting to come after us?
That's right. That's when they begin their strategy, doubt is our product. We make cigarettes, but most of all we make ignorance. We need more research. The facts are not all in. Cancer is complex.
No proven
disease.
Link.
There's no proof. We, you know, relax and have a smoke.
That lasted, what, 40 years?
Over 40 years, and elements of it are still in place. Mm-hmm. No cigarette manufacturer in the world has admitted that nicotine is addictive as heroin and cocaine. They've never admitted lying to the public. They've never admitted that filters are no safer, or lights are no safer, or low tars are no safer. Mm-hmm. They've never admitted that advertising causes people to smoke. So what I call the formal conspiracy was forcibly disbanded in 1999 with the Master Settlement Agreement, but most of the failures to admit are still alive today.
What about the perception that the Master Settlement Agreement, you know, solved the problem, that they were duly chastised, paid a heavy fine, and now they're selling it only to people who, you know, have made an adult choice to smoke, leave me alone, I just happen to enjoy my cigarette after dinner? Right.
Right. That's probably our biggest mythology, that this whole epidemic is something from the distant past, mm-hmm, when in fact there's still 1,400 Hawaiians who die every year from cigarettes. It's the leading cause of death in Hawaii, the leading cause of death in the United States, and the leading cause of death globally. And the idea that they paid all this money, that's true, but that $300 billion settlement effectively was about a 40-cent tax per pack on cigarettes. The companies just turned around and raised the price of cigarettes 45 cents, so they actually profited from it. And not only that, but in the Master Settlement Agreement, there's something called the Villainy Clause, which is you can't say that the tobacco industry is a villain. You can't, in any of these truth campaigns and so forth, you can't villainize the industry.
And that's what happens when you when you win a lawsuit. You agree not to criticize your antagonist any further,
it
right?
It can be that. It's up to the lawsuit.
But it's a fairly frequent provision.
Well, lawsuits are often secret. This one is not a secret
right.
settlement. But most importantly, maybe the cigarette companies only have to pay if their profits go below or remain above a certain level. If they drop below a certain level, they don't have to pay this huge settlement. So it's really a kind of a guaranteed profit program.
How is that not a kind of subsidy almost?
It is. Well, we have a long history of subsidizing tobacco, and elements of that still continue.
Well, okay, so it has now sunk into me. I'm a smoker, and I now know that sucking hot smoke into my lungs isn't the best idea. So now I've discovered this wonderful new way to get my fix, e-cigarettes, you know.
Right.
Have I solved my medical issues? Am I no longer at risk?
Well, it's certainly better in the sense that nothing could be probably worse than sucking ordinary tobacco smoke into your lung. Cigarettes have 600 different additives historically, ranging from castoreum, which is a anal secretion from the Siberian beaver, all the way up to, hormones of various sorts and pheromones and humectants.
What end? I mean, it started with Sir Walter Raleigh just taking a tobacco leaf and crushing it up, right?
Exactly. Well, by the 19th century, you're adding sugars to make it inhalable, milder. That's why the cigarette is not inherently deadly. It's dangerous by design because it's all the chemicals they add that allow it to be inhaled deep into the lungs, and that's what causes most of the harm. Now, what's happened more recently is since the 1950s, they really separated out what they call the unattractive side effects, which is the heart disease, the emphysema, the lung cancer.
Those are unattractive side
effects. Yeah, that's what they call them. And from which they really want, which is the addiction. Mm-hmm. So in a way, what they've designed are these perfect engines of addiction. They call them electronic cigarettes, vaping devices. And they're not supposed to produce those unattractive side effects, but no one really knows if they will. Mm-hmm. Do that because they do have all kinds of weird stuff, and some of the flavorants themselves could be harmful, things like diacetyl, which is popcorn, which is a known cause of popcorn lung, which is a form of emphysema. There's heavy metals, there's humectants, there's all kinds of other things. So it is, though, their dream. This is their dream to have moved from a tobacco industry to a cigarette industry, to selling smoke, to selling pure addiction. And that's what they're hoping with this new rage of the electronic cigarette is addiction in its purest form in the nicotine. And that's where they're going.
But young people have been drilled with the dangers of tobacco. Why would they embrace this? I mean, isn't it fairly obviously dangerous?
Well, nothing is obvious in this world, especially when it comes to tobacco. There's probably very few of our listeners who know that cigarettes are the leading cause of amputations. If you see a vet on the street with no legs, it's a much greater chance that they will have lost their legs from cigarettes, which cause vascular degeneration, loss of limbs. That's why the skin temperature of a smoker is several degrees cooler than that of a non-smoker. It's also why the cigarette industry used to advertise cigarettes as a natural form of air conditioning. You could sort of keep cool by having those blood vessels restricted. They don't know about the castoreum. They don't know that there's 8 million pounds of ammonia added to cigarettes. They don't know that it's a leading cause of blindness, the leading cause of fire death, a leading cause of impotence. You know, no one in the history of the world has ever smoked to look younger. And kids start off smoking. They like the danger. It's an attraction. It's forbidden fruit.
Yeah, yeah.
And so every time we say kids don't smoke, you might as well say, please smoke, because it's that forbidden nature. You know, the cigarette industry itself knows it's not for kids, just like sex, riding a motorcycle, drinking alcohol. Those are all non-kid things, right?
Well, let me take you back to history pre that meeting in the 50s you talked about. And I'm talking about, Betty Davis with the cigarette, with the backlit smoke. And I'm talking about troops overseas on both fronts of warfare in the Second World War being given all the cigarettes they could handle, right?
Oh, that's exactly right. Cigarettes are first given in World War I as part of rations. Mm-hmm. But even then, only 5 billion cigarettes were smoked by our troops in World War I versus 100 billion per year in World War II. The philosophy of smoke 'em if you got 'em. You know, you got a smoke break or you got no break. And so by the end of the war, the American military was requisitioning a third of all cigarettes just for our troops. And so that's why military men have been much more likely to become addicted and die from cigarettes, because they were pushed. They were tax-free, and they were, came with your rations in World War II.
And that's when we became a nation of smokers.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And it's why the military has suffered so much. Even Caspar Weinberger under Reagan tried to make, through Directive 1010, a smoke-free military, but Big Tobacco got laws passed in Congress requiring all ships to sell cigarettes and to allow smoking on all ships. And that's why U.S. naval submarines were not smoke-free until about 2 years ago. That's how much power the industry has had over our military.
It's not likely in the near term for that power to decline, I'm guessing.
Well, not so long as Philip Morris International is a $170 billion company. Remember, this is the best investment in the history of the world. $1 invested in tobacco stocks in 1900 is worth $12 million today. It's the most profitable enterprise in the history of capitalism, and more so than automobiles, electronics, chemicals, anything. These companies are still doing very well because the profit margins are so high, and I think that's going to continue for a while.
Well, what hope is there? How does one, you're part of an effort to push back against this, and what's one to do?
A lot, and Hawaii is one of the world's leaders here. Hawaii was the first state to introduce a minimum 21 law just mm-hmm. last year. We had here in Hawaii a ban on smoking in cars. One thing that needs to be done is the cigarettes need to be taxed more heavily. Hawaii is number 5 in the state taxes for cigarettes. New York, I think, is number 1. And cigarettes are taxed only 3 1/4 per pack. That should be $5 minimum. You shouldn't be able to buy cigarettes or electronic cigarettes within 1,000 feet of a school. We've still got that. So there's a lot of things that can be done. My own view is that global warming is so intertwined with tobacco that we're going to have to eventually ban the sale of cigarettes. And the reason I say that, and I say it, you know, without shame, is that most smokers don't like the fact they smoke. Most smokers wish they didn't smoke. It's not a recreational drug like marijuana or alcohol. It's much more like heroin in that sense. It's really more a form of slavery than it is an expression of freedom.
Because they're slaves, junkies don't care what something costs. Raising the price, you know, so what?
No, that's true. That's one reason that I think we need to look much more at actually curtailing opportunity. It's why smoke-free clean air laws have been so important. Vending machines are no longer legal in most states. It's the access that makes it so convenient, and that's where you have to stop.
Well, I hate to have to stop there, but that tells people a lot that they didn't know. You've got a command of a lot of information that I think is really...
Hopefully. It's really the tip of an iceberg.
Yeah. Thanks very much for coming in.
I appreciate it.
Dr. Robert Proctor will speak about Big Tobacco's continued use of inaccurate or misleading scientific data to create cultural doubt around the health consequences of its products. That's at the Coalition for a Tobacco-Free Hawaii's annual stakeholder meeting tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. at the Alohilani Resort in Waikiki. You can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Musicians love to shrug off our need for sleep.
We will never sleep, cause sleep is for the weak.
I never sleep, cause sleep is the cousin of death.
You don't need sleep. That was the thinking back in the 60s, and that's the thinking that I had.
Meet the man who went 11 days without sleep this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
This evening at 7.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, an effort to improve Hawaii County's bus system. But first, your quiz. The Honolulu Rapid Transit Company was founded in 1898 on the same day Hawaii was annexed by the United States. Now known as the bus, the old transit company operated streetcars, motor buses, and trolley buses, and worked primarily in Honolulu. In September of 1934, the Honolulu Rapid Transit Company introduced 22 new twin-coach gasoline buses that resemble the buses we see today. It took an investment of $150,000 to install those new buses. That's roughly $2.7 million today. For today's backyard quiz, can you give us the name of this new squadron of buses? Here's a hint. The United States just switched to a new currency standard in the previous year, and that may have inspired the name. We'll bring you the answer in the next half hour. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha mai kako. This is Ku'uwipo Kumukahi, Manager of Hawaiian Culture and Community Relations at the Hyatt Regency Waikiki. If you want to listen back to a show, visit the conversation at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Many working people on Hawaii Island depend on bus service for their livelihood. There are more jobs on the Kona than on the Hilo side, and there's a lengthy cross-island commute. The Heliaan service has been struggling, though. Ridership is down, and buses are in need of repair. The county council has commissioned a study of the service with community meetings scheduled into the coming year to gather input on a proposed master plan. We spoke with County Mass Transit Administrator Tiffany Kai about the current state of Heliaan.
We're facing some challenges. As you know, Mass Transit Agency operates a municipal bus system for Hawaii Island.
Right.
In addition to that, we have the shared ride and paratransit program. Operating a transit system for Hawaii County has been a challenge. The Big Island is 4,028 square miles.
Yeah.
Or the size of Connecticut, the state of Connecticut. So if you can imagine the land mass we need to cover. So basically, we service all the major highways except for the Daniel K. Inouye Highway.
Mm-hmm.
Our longest route is the Hilo to South Kona route, which is approximately 100 miles.
Yeah.
Yeah, so every year we average about 2.9 million vehicle revenue miles.
How long does it take to get from Hilo to South Kona on a bus?
About 3.5 hours.
Because you've got to make stops along the way, yeah?
Right, we do.
So that's obviously the biggest challenge, the sheer size. They don't call it the Big Island for nothing, right?
Correct. And besides the land area on the island, it's how the communities are dispersed as well.
Mm-hmm.
Transportation is highly demanded in the rural areas of Puna and Kau. And Puna, mind you, is the fastest growing community on the Big Island.
Right.
So one of the factors we came across, as we service the rural areas, are the roadway capacities causes restraint. So meaning roads are not up to standards or there's a lot of private roads in the rural areas.
Yeah.
So what we try to do to mitigate that is we work closely with the community associations, other departments, as well as the State Department of Transportation.
But you're going to run into issue where you just flat out need better roads. You're going to run into a whole issue of who's going to pay for it, right?
Exactly, the maintenance of the roads as well.
How do you, and then you've also got the maintenance of the buses themselves. How's that doing?
That's been, we've had our challenges in the past 6 months, but we're in a better place now. We're in the process of completing our mass transit base yard and maintenance facility, which, you know, has been in the making for the past 2 to 3 years. So that will benefit our operations tremendously. It's just going to be an overall better working environment for our mechanics. Right now, our existing maintenance facility is really old. We basically have only 2 stalls to work out of, compared to the new facility where we'll have 8.
So you'll be able to get the buses in need of repair back online a lot more quickly, it sounds like.
Right. I believe we'll be much more efficient with the space that we're going to be having.
Do you have the personnel to keep to ramp up your maintenance schedule?
Right now we have 5 mechanics, and we only have 1 maintenance facility in Hilo, which covers the Big Island. So that's another challenge that we're seeing. If we could get another maintenance facility, probably in West Hawaii, that will also help us. That way it will cut down the amount of travel time or response time we have when we need to respond to a breakdown.
Well, meanwhile, Tiffany, ridership has dropped, looks as pretty dramatically. How do you get those riders back? I mean, I assume you need that kind of ridership to keep the system running strong, yeah?
Correct. So, you know, once the transit master plan comes into place, we'll find, and we move forward with that, I'm sure that our ridership will be beefed up. You know, along with that, SSFM has been a big help in identifying our challenges and problem areas, as well as, you know, where we are today and where we need to go. So the transit master plan will be a huge, it'll make a huge impact for mass transit, as well as helping us to build that ridership. And our ridership was at an all-time high, I would say about 1.2 million. And at that time, that attributed to the free bus fares.
Are you optimistic?
I am.
Tiffany Kai is the acting administrator for the County of Hawaii Mass Transit Agency. The Transit Master Plan for Hawaii Island, commissioned by the county, is being created with community input by the consulting firm SSFM International. Cheryl Soon is the project manager, and we spoke with her the other day.
The master plan is in preparation. It's not been finalized.
Right, yeah.
What we've been working on for the past year is speaking to the drivers, talking to the passengers, and talking to people who used to be passengers who have stopped riding, and people who have thoughts about the transit system. We've done that in the form of onboard surveys. We've done electronic surveys, and in the past month of October, we held 5 public meetings around the island to gather input. When we met with them, we gave them proposals based on our initial reconnaissance of the system, proposals as to what were the important issues and how to address them. And we got feedback on them, both what additional issues were there and their reactions to the proposals that we had made. We are now in the process of redrafting those recommendations into what will become the draft master plan and putting prices to them, coming up with both a capital plan for buses as well as a full financial plan that addresses capital and operating expenses. We anticipate that draft will be available before the end of the year, and it will then be, there will be another round of public meetings. It will be posted electronically for further input and then for making into a final master plan.
Well, Cheryl, what are people telling you? What are the most, what are things emerge again and again?
I mean, I'm going to start with the positive because it's a very important place to start from. And that is that the people almost universally, I can't think of exceptions really, feel that the mass transit system on this island is vital to themselves personally and vital to the economy of the island. They are very, very supportive of having a mass transit system on the island. Secondly, they are telling us that they're aware of the problems and they're giving us some specifics and they're saying, keep working at it. Keep making it. We know you're working hard. Keep working on it. Keep making it better. The third thing that comes through is that, again, particularly from the current users, but from others as well who are potential users, is can you start earlier in the morning and can you go later at night?
Mm-hmm.
As well as could you do weekend? We do Saturday service, but can you do Sunday and holiday service? So we are looking, a lot of people are asking for expansion in time so that if the last bus is at 7 o'clock, they're saying that's not late enough for them in order to get back to where they're trying to get to. So they can't take it in the morning because they can't get back in the evening for the times that they need. The things that we're getting at the meetings have very much to do with people's commute schedule.
Yeah.
And many people here are on shift systems, particularly if they work at the hotel. So if your shift starts at 7 in the morning and you live in Pahoa, you've got to be taking a bus at 4 in the morning in order to make that. And in the afternoon back, you know, we're getting subtleties as, you know, can the 4:15 leave at 4:30 instead? Because sometimes my boss doesn't let me out right on time and I'm stuck if I can't, you know, take that afternoon bus. So it's subtleties having a lot to do with people's work schedules. In addition, and particularly at the CONA meeting, we had a lot of human resources directors come to that particular meeting, and they are telling us that they have a lot of jobs in the CONA area, and there aren't that many people in the CONA area to fill them, and they need to recruit, and there are a lot of people in the East Hawaii area who need jobs, and yet there are fewer jobs than there are over in West Hawaii. So can you find more times during the day to be bringing people back and forth, not only for interviews and for job recruitment, but then once they get the job?
Once they get the job, if you're in Hilo, where you need a job, and you're in Kona, where they have a job, you're looking at 2 hours at least each way on a bus, right?
Well, that's why we are now looking seriously, since the Daniel K. Inouye Highway was not serviceable for most of the past few years, but has recently opened the last section, that now becomes a viable option for bringing people over to their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're looking at, you know, how many times a day to do that. What's the specific routing? You know, can it leave from the center, Mohio Center in downtown Hilo? Can we collect people elsewhere, bring them to that one place, and then give them an express route? None of our routes are express. All of our routes make multiple stops. And so the recommendations we've made about the routing is let's get some express routes. Let's get some strong trunk routes. And then let's have circulators that do the gathering of people, deposit them at a hub location where they can transfer onto the buses that are taking the longer trips.
Well, Cheryl, you're still talking about getting from one end of the big island to another, even with an express route. How long would it take, Hilo to Kona?
Hilo to Kona is going to take about 1 hour and 25, 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Already the people in Kona who are going to the South Kahala resorts, they're on the bus for over 2 hours. People here need to connect to their jobs, and the location of housing, the location of jobs is just dramatically offset from one another. And while I'm sure government has its own policies for building affordable housing, in the meantime, the mass transit system is what makes a living possible for many people.
Cheryl Soon is a professional planner with SSFM International and the project manager of the Transit Master Plan for Hawaii Island, a work in progress. You can learn more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page. The public has come to see the Honolulu Rail Project as one that is barely able to meet its stated goal, a terminus at Ala Moana Center. There's some concern that its current $9 billion-plus price tag may not be enough to even do that, so the HART Board's stated intention to expand rail to UH and Waikiki may come as a surprise. Civil Beat reporter Stuart Yurton has that story in today's Reality Check. Good morning, Stuart.
Good morning, Chris.
How did this come out? It's a closed-door session there they've got scheduled, right?
Yes, that's right. So the whole thing is in fairly obscure governmentese, the way that this has been presented to the public so mm-hmm. far in the notice or the agenda of the HART board meeting. The agenda item simply says that they want to conduct planning and engineering activities and acquire the right of way to allow the development of the locally preferred alternative. In plain English, that means they're asking the city council for the green light to design an extension of the rail line to Manoa and Waikiki, and also to buy land along the route. So it's a pretty dramatic thing that they're starting out on, at least the beginning to, but it was in pretty obscure language.
Well, yeah, it sounds like it kind of got snuck onto the meeting agenda. There was no particular announcement or anything. You just looked at the agenda and found this item?
Well, actually, I need to give a shout-out to a new reporter we have. Marcel Honoré is coming to work for us.
Uh-huh.
Marcel mentioned it, pointed it out. He's starting next week and mentioned, hey, we might want to look into this. So we looked into it, and there we are. We saw it.
You would think that something of that magnitude would have merited an announcement, yeah? Am I wrong?
Well, it depends on what their goal is. If they don't want to have people talk about it, they could put it in this obscure language and hope it just sort of slides through and no one really thinks to ask.
Well,
especially since it is... Yeah, I'm sorry.
No, Stuart, I'm just saying, as you well know, as a reporter, if you try to slide something past the public and then it ends up in the newspaper, you've kind of defeated your purpose, haven't you?
Yes. Well, that has defeated the purpose. So it is in the paper. We're on it. Again, they're going to be discussing it in executive session. But I suppose if they come out and decide we do want to ask the city council for permission to do this, we'll know that, and we'll know what they're asking for permission to do. And we'll also know to be on the alert when it goes to the city council and the city council decides what to do about this, as they call it, the locally preferred alternative, which really means the route to Manoa and Waikiki.
Well, you know, the whole idea of that, I mean, we've been hearing how strapped they were, and doing a study costs money, doesn't it?
Well, right. Not only doing the study, but again, remember, they have permission to acquire the right-of-way to allow development. So they can be buying land as well if they get permission to do this.
And yet, you know, when this was before the legislature a couple of months ago, it was, as my memory serves, presented as something that we will barely make it with this additional funding.
Yes, that's right. Well, that's been part of the discussion. I spoke to Sylvia Luke, the House Finance Committee Chair, who was part of the help put the bailout deal together, the $2.4 billion bailout measure. And she said, don't even think about more money until you show you can get to Ala Moana on budget and in time.
Well, somebody's thinking about it, Stuart. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Chris.
Every day we bring you a Reality Check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Stuart Yurton.
HPR's Atherton Studio is the place to find so many of Hawaii's musical stars. On Saturday the 18th, it's vocalist Star Kalahiki with her longtime collaborator, pianist Kit Ebersbach. They'll delight you with lounge standards, show tunes, and Hawaiian classics. Your tickets are at 955-8821 during business hours or hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership, Wealth Management.
Founded in 1898, the Honolulu Rapid Transit Company is now the bus. The transit company operated primarily in Honolulu, while other rival transportation companies worked outside the capital city, starting with streetcars, then motor buses and trolley buses. In September of 1934, the transit company introduced 22 brand new twin coach gasoline buses into its armada of public transportation vessels. The cost was $150,000, or about $2.7 million in today's dollars. For today's backyard quiz, we asked if you could name this group of buses. Our hint was that the U.S. switched to a currency standard in the previous year that may have inspired the name. At the time, the domestic economy was taken off the gold standard, placed on the silver standard for the first time, and the new buses were called the Silver Fleet. Nobody got that today, but that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. This has been a bad year for coral bleaching around the world, a trend directly linked to global warming. Hawaiian waters have seen two serious bleaching events in recent years. It's a serious concern and a specialized area of study for research ecologist Tom Oliver, who studies the relationship between ocean temperatures and damage to coral reefs at NOAA's Pacific Island Fisheries Science Center. He came to our studio to fill us in.
Coral bleaching is the breakdown in the symbiosis that supports corals. A simpler way of saying that is basically when temperature gets a little bit too hot, about a degree above summertime maxima, corals get sick and they turn white. So they leave these little algae that normally live inside corals behind. And so you just see coral animal tissue on top of white coral skeleton. And it can be really visually arresting, but it is not a death sentence. Corals can recover from that. But if that temperature stress is prolonged or severe, they can die.
And we've seen that happen.
Yes, we have seen that happen. And we've seen it happen all over the world. Over the last few years, we've had what we call the third global coral bleaching event. Here in Hawaii, we've actually been pretty lucky up until now, and we've missed out on a lot of bleaching. The first time we ever saw it here was 1996, 18, and that was pretty mild. And then 18 years later, we saw bleaching in both 2014 and 2015.
Separate events.
Separate events, but back-to-back bleaching events.
With what result?
Pretty bad result for the state. So in 2014, Papanaumokuakea bleached pretty hard. And in 2015, here, the main Hawaiian Islands bleached pretty hard. Here in the mains, that 2015 event, we saw 46% of all of the corals here in the mains that we surveyed showed signs of impact, so paling or bleaching. And then comparing surveys to before and after the event, we saw that our total live coral declined by about 30%, 32% decline.
You know, we tend to think of damage to coral as a result of human intervention, but if you're telling me it happened at Papahanaumokuakea, that's not any place where there are very few people anywhere near the reef there, and yet the same thing happened.
Yeah, I mean, and that's true actually globally. Like some of the worst impacts on the Great Barrier Reef happened in the northern Great Barrier Reef.
Where no people go.
Very few people. And an extreme example of this, we go at NOAA, where I work, we spend a lot of time surveying reefs in the remote Pacific. And one of these reefs is a place called Jarvis Island, which is possibly the most remote reef from human impacts anywhere. And it bleached to 98% mortality in 2015.
That's frightening on a number of levels because the implications, what are the implications of something like that?
Well, the implications of something like that are that the exposure to temperature stress doesn't really care what you do or how you protect it or what's happening. The ocean is warming and it's going to get hot kind of haphazardly, regardless of where humans is. The other side of that coin, though, is how reefs resist, recover from, and potentially over a longer term adapt to temperature stress are likely things that we can impact.
How?
How is a really great question, and actually a question that a lot of scientists here in Hawaii have been aggressively pursuing. Just this year, the Department of Aquatic Resources for Hawaii released something called the Coral Bleaching Recovery Plan, in which they surveyed global scientists, scientists here in Hawaii, and looked across all of the scientific literature they could to rank actions that we could take in terms of management, to see which actions would best promote recovery mm-hmm. after a bleaching event.
So recovery can be accomplished, but what is the best action? What are the best actions to take?
I would say the plan is up there, and you can read it. The best actions sort of fall into a group of different categories. Prime among them is really maintaining the populations of herbivores on our reefs, because when corals die, the next thing that comes in is algae.
Mm-hmm.
And once algae occupy that space, it's pretty hard to get rid of.
Yeah.
So by having a lot of herbivores around, they can really graze down that algae and promote the recovery of the reef, so that when reefs basically have babies and they send their larvae around, there's a place for those babies to land and grow. And so a lot of the actions ranked in that recovery plan focus on ways that we can support that core service.
What are the herbivores? What are some herbivores that eat algae?
There's a whole bunch of them. So from manini, little convict tangs, to mm-hmm. uhu, the big parrotfish, and a bunch of some of the most spectacular fish that we see out on our reefs are herbivores.
Can they be, once you start moving species from one place to another, you've got a recipe for trouble, as
that's true.
We have seen time and time again. So it isn't just a matter of, dumping a bunch of manini into an area that's got too many algae, right?
No, I mean, it's really a question more of how do we modify our human behavior in a way to promote those classes. And there's a bunch of – I don't want to focus entirely on herbivores, because there's a bunch of other steps, including mm-hmm. increasing enforcement, doing a better job of dealing with sediment and nutrients on land.
Mm-hmm.
And on some level, promoting adaptation. There's a lot of folks who are looking at restoring coral reefs, and in particular by focusing on corals that they know to resist temperature stress well.
Temperature stress, as you said earlier, can be as little as a 1 degree change in an average high temperature?
Correct, yeah. So the recognized sort of rule of thumb guideline for temperature stress is 1 degree above your averaged hottest summer month.
Mm-hmm.
And once you get above that, you start seeing substantial bleaching and mortality, potentially.
Like most scientists, you have long since accepted global warming as fact.
That is correct, yeah.
And you are in good company with virtually every other scientist on the face of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
However, your views are treated as opinions rather than facts and are not shared by the people running this country right now, right?
That appears to be the case, yeah.
So that's a fairly sizable, that makes things a little bit difficult for what you're describing, doesn't it?
It does and it doesn't. I think we've seen in a number of ways that even without leadership at the highest levels, there's a lot of different levels of government making action
mm-hmm.
on climate change. I have to be a little careful here because I am a federal NOAA scientist, and
right.
it is very much my job to describe the science,
mm-hmm.
But not to advocate for any particular action.
No,
what the science shows, though, is that humans are causing climate change, that already we're seeing major impacts due to climate change on our reefs, and that impact is likely to get worse.
The difficulties of making science, pursuing science in a world that is increasingly doubtful of scientific conclusions, that's got to make your job more difficult, doesn't it?
I mean, it does. Largely my job, honestly, is to evaluate the best available science and communicate that to policymakers
mm-hmm.
and really make both the public and policymakers clear of what the implications of particular actions are. And I honestly, here in Hawaii, have been pretty positively impressed with both the general public and now even the legislature's willingness to take these matters seriously and to really try to ask what are the best actions to move forward. So here locally, and really when we're talking about reefs in Hawaii, it is local action that's going to really tip the scales for resistance and recovery. And I've been positively impressed with what's going on here locally.
Well, let's just say that you were given the power and the resources to really address this problem on the scale at which it deserves to be addressed. What would you do?
It's a great question, and honestly, again, one that I'm going to have to defer to. It's my role here to present the science.
Mm-hmm.
What I would do is bring all the science that we can and show the scale of the impacts that we're seeing to the policymakers, and we're doing that, and at the same time provide a roadmap for those actions that are most likely to change that, and mm-hmm. we have that in the Coral Bleaching Recovery Plan.
And though that roadmap would include things like what you described, bringing in species to devour the algae, allow coral to
thrive. Wouldn't put it as bringing them in. We're not talking about moving things around so much as really thinking about the ways that we fish in those areas,
mm-hmm.
And other kinds of protection, whether it's just enforcing existing fishing regulations, doing new fisheries regulations, or really looking at some spatial management. So Governor Ige, for example, has the 30 by 30 initiative, where it's proposed to effectively manage 30% of the coastal waters by 2030.
Mm-hmm.
And those kinds of initiatives are the sorts of things that could make a major impact on resistance and recovery.
But you do see hope for addressing coral bleaching.
I do see hope, but I see the first line of hope really is seeing people accept the scale of the impacts. And I've accepted that for years now.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really the first step towards our taking other steps that we can do that. And that's starting to occur. I think most people are really aware of this is a big deal and we need to figure out what we can do. I also see a lot of hope as a biologist. I'm an evolutionary ecologist by training, and corals are a really wonderful organism if you want to think about something that can adapt to new conditions.
Yeah.
They're not monolithic. They're not one thing. There are hundreds of species of corals. They have different kinds of algae inside of them that can react differently to the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And there are corals out there that can survive some of this.
They're survivors.
They are survivors. And the question is just whether we can give them enough of a leg up, that reefs as a whole can adapt to these changes fast enough. Reefs have been through a lot, and they're able to take a lot, but they can't take it infinitely fast.
And as reefs go, a lot of things go with them.
That's true. A lot of benefits go with them, in particular how we feed ourselves. We eat a lot of fish that come off of our reefs. With reefs go protection for our shorelines, especially as swells are coming up and sea level rise is occurring. That's even more and more important. With reefs also go all the diversity that lives on them. So globally, a quarter of marine diversity can be found on a coral reef somewhere. It's an enormous number. And really, the beauty of reefs, especially here in Hawaii, is not only an aesthetic concern, but it also draws tourists here. And it really is part of what makes Hawaii such a special place.
Dr. Tom Oliver is a research ecologist at NOAA's Pacific Islands Fisheries Science Center. His research experience has mostly focused on the way reef corals respond to changing temperatures and ocean acidity, with a particular focus on the ways local management actions can support ecosystem responses to these global threats. There are a lot of different activities going on throughout the state, and Morning Edition host and our colleague Derek Malama joins us for a look at events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar. Today, we've got something going in Kaneohe tomorrow. Yeah?
Right. It's a play by Neil Simon. His second play from 1963, A Barefoot in the Park, is about a newlywed couple living in Greenwich Village, navigating the bumps to a balanced relationship. This play ran for 1,500 performances on Broadway when it came out, and it became a film starring Robert Redford
uh-huh.
and Jane Fonda. You may remember that.
Yes, I do.
Yeah. It premieres tomorrow at 7:30 in HPU's Paul and Vailu Theater in Kaneohe.
I think those two might even have been in the Broadway show. I'm trying to remember, but I do remember that.
Yes.
And here's a chance to bring the family to Makawao Town for a free party.
That's happening tomorrow, and they have this every third Friday of the month. It has music, Ono food, arts and crafts, and more. The Makawao Third Friday Town Party is from 6 to 9 p.m., and it's free. And once again, bring the whole family to this one.
I love upcountry Maui.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Great?
It's beautiful.
You can enjoy free music in the park tomorrow in Kona.
The West Hawaii County Band presents an hour of music in its monthly Free Friday concert, and the program features Hawaiian music, marches, music from the movies, traditional band favorites, and jazz hits. This is happening at 6:30 in Hale Halawai County Park in Kona, and this is free as well.
Nice to see so many free events going
on. It's great.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that might be going on a little under the radar. You can always find out more about them on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
This week on Says You. Well, think of like idiomatic and idiopathic, idiosyncrasy.
Right.
What do they all have to do with?
I don't know, but I'm feeling like one right now.
Well, this is getting deep.
A game as fast as it's fun, and everyone's a winner, says you.
This evening at 6:30, following Marketplace.
And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. Up tomorrow, we'll look at the healing power of the ukulele. Tell us what you think about anything you heard on the program by calling our talkback line at 808-792-8217. You also can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, where you can find more information about today's topics, along with links to our daily podcast. I'm Chris Vanderkook. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.